doubt, their horrifying means of exclusion. Unimaginable, unthinkable, unheard of, these are the adjectives of doubt. Marguerite wrote in pain, in waiting for the return of her deported husband, of pain and imagining. The battle I engaged in cannot be known by anybody. I fight against the image of a dark ditch. On some moments the image is stronger, then I scream or I go out the door and walk through Paris. Day says, if you remember this later, you will be ashamed of yourself. The irony of the phenomena concerning pain and imagination is that most research has been directed towards extreme circumstances. On the one hand, we know quite a lot about the infliction of torture, as well as the structure of the type of regimes that apply torture. We know of pain that arises from loss, dying, and facing death. Documentation on the horrors of war makes us being able to imagine what these horrors could imply for the people involved. On the other hand, there are clear-cut boundaries where this imagination of pain inflicted on others is concerned. These are two-folded taboos on such imagination. The first one becomes immediately clear from Marguerite's description. If an individual truly suffers from imagination of a loved one being in pain or death, the image of a dark ditch, then such suffering is considered to be a sick state of mind in the midst of judgment. But worse, an act of theatrical hypocrisy that can only lead to shame and embarrassment. The second one is closely connected to the capacity for imagination itself. If imagination does not contain an immediate seeable object, it is regarded as insanity, period. And indeed, where imagination is concerned, it is the available object that makes the difference. This object, being a text or a piece of art, creates the guidelines for health and expressibility. Why is this concentration on extreme circumstances of pain and imagination so important? And why does such concentration always include a visible object? Why is medical science capable of transplanting 3 organs in an individual in 1 operation, but does it virtually know nothing about the perception of pain compared to its alleged progress on all other fields? Why did it take the UN so long to be convinced about the inhuman torturous crimes in Kuwait during the Gulf War? Part of the answers might be that both the medical professions as well as the military intervention apply the same instruments which they battle. But rather, to view such instrument through justification as you can break the omelet knot without breaking the axe, or we apply violence only if necessary and only for military targets. Behind the scene lies the instrument of such justification itself, which is doubt. Indeed, that wonderful means of excluding the individual body from the communal utopia. One much extended word on this subject has been written by Eileen Skerry, and it's called The Body in Pain, The Making and Unmaking of the World. Though again she focuses partly on rather extreme circumstances, she also involves processes concerning the transformation of pain and imagination into the creation of artifacts and language. On the subject of doubt, she writes, "So for the person in pain, so incontestably and unnegotiable present is that having pain may come to be thought of as the most vibrant example of what it is to have certainty, while for the other person it is so elusive that hearing about pain may exist as the primary model of what it is to have doubt." This model of doubt, however, goes a little beyond the scope of implying pain can be an unaffirmed sentient state. It is indeed true that most philosophers prefer to explain all other internal sentient states as connected with external objects such as fear of, the feelings from, etc., and that the exclusive internal character of pain gives it a special place in the world of language. But it is also possible that this is not the result of the exclusivity of pain. Instead, it is the result of the creation of the boundaries that construct the sensorium with communal language. These boundaries might be called average. The average person does not feel pain unless inflicted onto him. The average person does feel love, the fear for, but never feels without an external object. Scarry continues. This list and its implicit affirmation would, however, be suddenly interrupted when, moving through the human interior, one at last reached physical pain, for physical pain, unlike any other state of consciousness, has no referential contact. It is not of or for anything. It is precisely because it takes no object that it, more than any other phenomena, resists objectification in language. It is precisely because pain has been researched in the context of excess which leads Eileen Scarry to come to this conclusion. And here I disagree, and you would too. Probably because to me it seems that there are enormous amount of internal states within the life of individuals that have no referential content and equally resist objectification in language. It is, for instance, what babies and very young children continuously suffer, or very old demented people, in fact, in those stages of life where they have been objectively excluded from engaging in language. It is for this reason that pain has no exclusive character, though not for this reason alone. The other is exclusion from time, and thereby from change. Indeed, the Saad was imprisoned, but from his letters to his wife, I get the impression that his imprisonment was rather more bearable than the certainty about the duration of his imprisonment. His fixation with numbers, as you well observed, equals his repeated requests for knowledge on the duration, to such an extent that they eventually become codes of silence, which the Saad, at exactly that point, views as cruelty. I wonder what would happen, as a hypothetical matter, if there would be a recognition for the fact that people are able of communicating without the intermediacy of an external object. For posing such a hypothesis alone, I might be classified in as obscure and bizarre alone. However, states like that frequently occur. They might be states that are states of a child feeling that the presence of its mother, without actually her being there. It might concern a highly sensitive person who does not need the presence of another in order to register so-and-so's emotions. It might also concern the clairvoyant who dreams of the bombing of a civilian bunker in Baghdad while hearing on television that on exactly the same time a military target was precisely bombarded by UN airplanes. The answer to such a hypothetical situation would be, of course, that these individuals do not communicate without the intermediacy of an object, but that imagines communication. Hence, they compensate their unidentifiable state of mind by imagining an external object. In the Saad's case, this external object would logically consist of numbers. And indeed, the conclusion would be that the individual in question does not actually experience an internal sentient. Or, as Eileen Scarry writes, physical pain, then, is an internal intentional state without an intentional object. Imagining is intentional object without an experienceable intentional state. Thus, it may be that in some peculiar way it is appropriate to think of pain as an imagination's intentional states and to identify imagination as the pain intentional's object. This, unfortunately, does not satisfy my curiosity at all, as it implies that the baby, the sensitive person, or the clairvoyant remain in a constant state of pain and that their means of communication consists entirely of intentional objects. Again, an approach that centralizes the doubt, and to some extent would also enable us this deconstruct this doubt, but still maintains an individual body in an isolated state of sentient, through which it virtually remains quite powerless, fantastic, extremized and obscured. It also suggests that the motivation in creating such an intentional object remains the result of an individually isolated pain. And it ensures at the same time, as a matter of fact, that one person could never feel the pain of another person, as this can only be an imagined pain. This, nevertheless, also ensures the framing habits of language as a necessary means for communication, but in the background, unintentionally maybe, it also ensures the framing habits of language to remain in control of individual perception. Eileen Scarry concludes, that is, pain and imagining are the framing events within whose boundaries all other perceptual, somatic and emotional events occur. This between the two extremes can be mapped the whole terrain of the human psychic. This framing, I feel, is much more important than the extremes that continuously seem to determine pain and imagination. In terms of social construction, under such conditions, we would not be able to determine whether or not the framing does not more harm, and the framing itself is inflicting the pain. It is in fact the body which is being framed by rationality, of the alleged external world, a very peculiar, but also, though not exclusively, Western approach of the sensorium of the body. This body sensorium is described by many philosophers in the Western tradition in fairly the same way. So too by Eileen Scarry, that is. It is because vision and hearing are, under ordinary conditions, so exclusively bound up with their object rather than their bodily location, that they are senses most frequently invoked by poets as sensory analogues for imagination. Here again, the focus is on the difference between distancing senses and proximity senses, the distancing senses being more suitable for imagination, while the proximity senses, as touch or bodily feeling, are more perceptible to pain. Again, we enter the double mirror of desire, which reflects both pain and imagination. If the other is not present to serve as a disembodiment for pleasure, then the individual will imagine the other. And this imagining is always preferable, if not superior, to what Scarry calls naturally occurring objectlessness. It seems too perfect to be true. In fact, it cannot be. For describing extremes of embodiment and disembodiment, of absolute self and imagined other, leads through its own internal opposition towards the construction of desire. It is there as a result of a Western construction of the sensorium, which again is based on this undeniable proof of presence of the thing, which could be called the murder weapon by now. It also invites another opposition, which is even more hierarchical. This opposition suggests that the objectlessness of natural occurrence is inferior to the superiority of imagination. Though on the surface such imagination implies that there is better to communicate something rather than hoping for the other to understand the state of pain, it also continues the notion that it is better to doubt individuals than it is to feel and understand the other. As such, it is the superiority of objectification which leads to the desire for the object. Hence, the desolate loneliness of the lover, who would otherwise not be lonely, but rather enjoying him or herself. Such loneliness, or rather the image of loneliness, has become an almost scientific construct which urges people, under ordinary, natural circumstances, to feel deprived of any object offered to them at a convenience distance. Equally, such objectification offers an imagined sharing of pain which is equally presented at a convenient distance. as it does not touch the inside. In this sense, language remains a mediator, which, Western or otherwise, maintains the very nature of this distance. Pain becomes theatrical, and to put it in the words of Rousseau, the pain viewed in drama sometimes brings tears to the eyes of people who would never shed a tear over the pain of the loss of a close person. But to be in pain is not to want to be understood, but to want the pain to stop. The state's fixation with number does not imply the imagination of an external object, but rather signify a sense of control over the duration of his agony. What he tried to make his wife understand was his need to be physically present in time instead of being physically imprisoned by numbers. The consequences of a body absent in language might result in the creation of new objects, say new bodies, but the shared sentient is never actually there, at least not by means of language, and neither by means of the objects. One of the reasons I admire your work so much is that you have never taken the presence of the individual body as self-evident. Be it on part of the individual who expresses this in language, it always takes a considerable activity on the other side of the reader of that expression to understand the message. And even then, such a message is dynamic, as it changes continuously over time. It is not surprising, then, that you equally probed one of the most desired mediators, which have served as one of the strongest objectifications of the last century. This is photography and its imaginative capacity, or rather, the metonymic relation between photography and desire.